Eton, where he would have mixed with other gentlemen, and not with the sons of local tradesmen, and in Clifton's case, far worse. Elizabeth retreated into the comparative safety of silence, as she had so often done recently. Chapter 26.
"Local tea shop burnt to the ground, arson suspected," hollered the paper boy, standing on the corner of the broad.
Hugo threw on the brakes, leapt out of his car, and handed the lad a halfpenny. He began reading the front page as he walked back to his car. Tilly's Tea Shop, a Bristol landmark much frequented by local citizens, was razed to the ground in the early hours of the morning. Police have arrested a local man in his early 30s and charged him with arson. Miss Tilly, who now lives in Cornwall... Hugo smiled when he saw the photograph of Maisie Clifton and her staff standing on the pavement, grimly surveying the burnt-out remains of Tilly's. The gods were clearly on his side. He climbed back into his car, placed the newspaper on the passenger seat, and continued on his journey to Bristol Zoo. He would need to make an early appointment to see Mr. Prendergast. Mitchell had advised him that if he hoped to keep the fact that he was the subject's backer confidential, any meetings with Prendergast should be held in Barrington's offices, and preferably after Miss Potts had gone home for the night. Hugo didn't attempt to explain to Mitchell that he wasn't sure if Miss Potts did go home at night. He was looking forward to the meeting with Prendergast, when he would administer the last rites. But there was someone else he needed to see before he could do that. Mitchell was feeding Rosie when he arrived. Hugo walked slowly across, leant on the railing, and pretended to take an interest in the Indian elephant that Bristol Zoo had recently acquired from Uttar Pradesh and was already attracting a large number of visitors. Mitchell tossed up a lump of bread, which Rosie caught in her trunk and transferred to her mouth in one fluid movement. "The subject has returned to work at the Royal Hotel," said Mitchell, as if he was addressing the elephant. "She's doing the late shift in the Palm Court from 10 at night until 6 the following morning. She's paid £3 a week, plus whatever she can make in tips, which, as there are so few customers at that time of night, doesn't add up to much." He threw another crust at the elephant and continued, "A Bob Burrows has been arrested and charged with arson. Burrows was her patisserie supplier before the subject sacked him. He's made a full confession, even admitting that he had planned to propose to the subject and had purchased an engagement ring, but she'd spurned him. Or at least, that's his story." A smile crossed Hugo's lips. "And who's in charge of the case?" he asked. "A Detective Inspector Blakemore," said Mitchell. Hugo's smile was replaced by a frown. "Although Blakemore initially thought the subject might be an accomplice of Burroughs," continued Mitchell, "he has since informed the Bristol and West of England Insurance Company that she is no longer a suspect."
"That's a pity," said Hugo, the frown still in place.
"Not necessarily," said Mitchell.
"The insurance company will be issuing Mrs. Clifton with a cheque for £600 in full and final settlement of her claim."
Hugo smiled.
"I wonder if she's told her son," said Hugo, almost to himself.
If Mitchell heard the comment, he ignored it. "The only other piece of information that might be of some interest to you," he continued, "is that Mr. Patrick Casey booked into the Royal Hotel on Friday night and took the subject to the Plimsoll line for dinner. They returned to the hotel afterwards, when she accompanied him to his room, number 371, and didn't leave until just after 7 o'clock the following morning." A long silence followed, always the sign that Mitchell had come to the end of his monthly report. Hugo removed an envelope from an inside pocket and slipped it to Mitchell, who didn't acknowledge the transaction, as he threw his last piece of bread to a contented Rosie.
"Mr. Prendergast to see you," said Miss Potts,
standing aside to allow the banker to enter the managing director's office.
"It's good of you to come all this way," said Hugo. "I'm sure you'll appreciate why I didn't want to discuss such a highly confidential matter at the bank."
"I quite understand," said Prendergast, who had opened his Gladstone bag and extracted a thick file even before he'd sat down. He passed a single sheet of paper across the desk to Mr. Barrington.
Hugo checked the bottom line before settling back in his chair.
"Just to recap, if I may," said Prendergast, "you put up a capital sum of £500, which allowed Mrs. Clifton to purchase the business known as Tilly's, a tea shop on Broad Street. The agreed contract was for the full amount, plus compound interest at 5% per annum, to be paid back to the principal within a period of 5 years.
Although Tilly's managed to declare a small trading profit in Mrs. Clifton's first year and again in her second, there was never a large enough surplus for her either to pay the interest or to return any part of the capital sum, so, at the time of the fire, Mrs. Clifton owed you £572.16. To this sum I must add bank charges of £20, making a grand total of £592.16. This, of course, will be well covered by the insurance payout, which means that while your investment is secure, Mrs. Clifton will be left with virtually nothing."
"How unfortunate," said Hugo.
"May I ask why the final sum doesn't appear to include any charge for services rendered by Mr. Casey?" he added, after studying the figures more closely.
"Because Mr. Casey has informed the bank that he will not be submitting any bills for his services."
Hugo frowned. "At least that is one piece of good news for the poor woman."
"Indeed. Nonetheless, I fear she will no longer be able to cover her son's fees at Bristol Grammar School for next term."
"How sad," said Hugo. "So will the boy have to be removed?"
"I'm sorry to say that's the inevitable conclusion," said Mr. Prendergast. "It is a great shame, because she dotes on the child, and I believe she would sacrifice almost anything to keep him there."
"A great shame," repeated Hugo, as he closed the file and rose from his chair. "I won't keep you any longer, Mr. Prendergast," he added. "I have an appointment in the city in about half an hour. Perhaps I can give you a lift."
"That is most kind of you, Mr. Barrington, but it won't be necessary. I drove myself over here."
"What do you drive?" Hugo asked, as he picked up his briefcase and headed towards the door.
"A Morris Oxford," said Prendergast, quickly stuffing some papers back into his Gladstone bag and following Hugo out of the office.
"The people's car," said Hugo. "I'm told that, like you, Mr. Prendergast, it's very reliable."
Both men laughed as they walked down the stairs together.
"Sad business, Mrs. Clifton," said Hugo as they stepped out of the building. "But then I'm not altogether sure I approve of women getting involved in business. It's not the natural way of things."
"I quite agree," said Prendergast, as the two men came to a halt by Barrington's car. "Mind you," he added, "you could not have done more for the poor woman."
"It's kind of you to say so, Prendergast," said Hugo. "But despite that, I'd be obliged if my involvement could remain strictly between the two of us."
"Of course, sir," said Prendergast, as the two men shook hands. "You can rely on me."
"Let's keep in touch, old fellow," said Hugo as he climbed into his car. "I have no doubt I'll be calling on the bank's services again."
Prendergast smiled.
As Hugo drove towards the city, his thoughts returned to Maisie Clifton. He had dealt her a blow from which she was unlikely to recover, but he now intended to deliver the knockout punch. He drove into Bristol, wondering where she was at that moment. Probably sitting her son down to explain to him why he would have to leave BGS at the end of the summer term. Had she even for one fleeting moment imagined that Harry might be able to continue his studies as if nothing had happened? Hugo decided that he wouldn't raise the subject with Giles until the boy told him the sad news that his friend Harry would not be returning to BGS to join him in the sixth form.
Even the thought of his own son having to go to Bristol Grammar School still made him pulse with anger. But he had never let Elizabeth or his father know the real reason Giles had failed to get a place at Eton. Once he'd driven past the cathedral, he continued across College Green before turning into the entrance of the Royal Hotel. He was a few minutes early for his appointment, but he was confident the manager would not keep him waiting. He pushed his way through the revolving doors and strolled across the lobby, not needing to be told where Mr. Frampton's office was. The manager's secretary leapt up the moment Hugo entered the room. "I'll let Mr. Frampton know you're here," she said, almost running into the adjoining office. The manager appeared a moment later. "What a pleasure to see you, Mr. Barrington," he said, ushering him into his office. "I do hope you and Mrs. Barrington are both well." Hugo nodded and took a seat opposite the hotel manager, but didn't shake hands. "When you asked to see me, I took the liberty of checking over the arrangements for your company's annual dinner," said Frampton. "Just over 300 guests will be attending, I understand." "I have no interest how many guests are attending," said Hugo. "That isn't the reason I came to see you, Frampton. I wish to discuss a private matter that I find most distasteful." "I'm very sorry to hear that," said Frampton, sitting bolt upright. One of our non-executive directors was staying at the hotel on Thursday night, and the following day he made a most serious allegation that I feel it is my duty to bring to your attention. "Yes, of course," said Frampton, rubbing his sweating palms on his trousers. "The last thing we would want to do is annoy one of our most valued customers." "I'm glad to hear it," said Hugo. The gentleman in question checked into the hotel after the restaurant had closed and went into the palm court in the hope of being provided with some light refreshment. "A service I myself instituted," said Frampton, allowing himself a strained smile. "He gave his order to a young lady who appeared to be in charge," continued Hugo, ignoring the comment. "Yes, that would be our Mrs. Clifton." "I've no idea who it was," said Hugo. "However, as she was serving him with a cup of coffee and some sandwiches, another gentleman entered the palm court, made an order, and asked if it could be sent up to his room. The only thing my friend recalls about the man was that he had a slight Irish accent. My friend then signed his bill and retired for the night. He rose early the following morning, as he wished to have breakfast and go over his papers before the board meeting. When he came out of his room, he observed the same woman, still dressed in her hotel uniform, leaving room 371. She then walked to the end of the corridor, climbed through the window, and out onto the fire escape. I'm absolutely appalled, sir. The board member concerned has requested that whenever he comes to Bristol in the future, he should be booked into another hotel. Ah, I don't wish to appear prudish, Frampton, but the Royal has always been somewhere I have been happy to bring my wife and children. Be assured, Mr. Barrington, the person concerned will be dismissed immediately and not supplied with a reference. May I add how grateful I am that you have brought this matter to my attention." Hugo rose from his place. "Of course. I wouldn't want any reference made to me or the company should you feel it necessary to dismiss the lady in question. You can be assured of my discretion," said Frampton. Hugo smiled for the first time. "On a happier note, may I say how much we're all looking forward to the annual dinner, which no doubt will be up to your usual high standard. Next year we'll be celebrating the company's centenary, so I feel sure my father will want to push the boat out." Both men laughed a little too loudly. "You can rely on us, Mr. Barrington," said Frampton, as he followed his client out of the office. "And one more thing, Frampton," said Hugo as they walked across the foyer. "I'd rather you didn't say anything to Sir Walter about this. My father can be a little old-fashioned when it comes to such matters, so I think it's best kept between ourselves." "I couldn't agree more, Mr. Barrington," said Frampton. You can be assured I shall deal with the matter personally."
As Hugo pushed his way back through the revolving doors, he couldn't help wondering just how many hours Mitchell must have spent at the Royal before he was able to supply him with such a priceless piece of information. He jumped back into his car, switched on the engine, and continued on his journey home. He was still thinking about Maisie Clifton when he felt a tap on his shoulder. He experienced a moment of blind panic as he turned around and saw who was sitting on the back seat. He even wondered if somehow she'd found out about his meeting with Frampton. "What do you want?" he demanded, not slowing down for fear that someone might see them together. As he listened to her demands, he could only wonder how she was so well informed. Once she'd finished, he readily agreed to her terms, knowing that it would be the easiest way of getting her out of the car. Mrs. Clifton placed a thin brown envelope on the passenger seat next to him. "I'll wait to hear from you," she said. Hugo put the envelope in an inside pocket. He only slowed down when he came to an unlit alley, but didn't stop until he was certain no one else could see them. He leapt out of the car and opened the back door. When he saw the look on her face, it was clear she felt she'd more than achieved her purpose. Hugo allowed her a moment of triumph before he grabbed her by the shoulders and shook her as if he was trying to remove an obstinate apple from a tree. Once he'd left her in no doubt what would happen if she ever bothered him again, he punched her in the face with all his strength. She collapsed to the ground, curled up into a ball, and didn't stop shaking. Hugo thought about kicking her in the stomach, but didn't want to risk being witnessed by a passerby. He drove away without giving her another thought.
Old Jack Tarr, 1925 to 1936. Chapter 27. On a balmy Thursday afternoon in the northern Transvaal, I killed 11 men, and a grateful nation awarded me the Victoria Cross for service above and beyond the call of duty. I haven't had a peaceful night's sleep since. If I'd killed one Englishman in my homeland, a judge would have sentenced me to hang by the neck until I was dead. Instead, I have been sentenced to life imprisonment because I still see the faces of those 11 wretched young men every day, like an image on a coin that never fades. I've often considered suicide, but that would be the coward's way out. In the citation gazetted in the Times, it was stated that my actions had been responsible for saving the lives of 2 officers, 5 non-commissioned officers, and 17 private soldiers of the Royal Gloucesters. One of those officers, Lieutenant Walter Barrington, has made it possible for me to serve my sentence with some dignity. Within weeks of the action, I was shipped back to England, and a few months later I was honourably discharged following what would now be described as a mental breakdown. After 6 months in an army hospital, I was released back into the world. I changed my name, avoided my hometown of Wells in Somerset, and set off for Bristol. Unlike the prodigal son, I refused to travel a few miles into the next county, where I would have been able to enjoy the tranquility of my father's home. During the day, I would roam the streets of Bristol, rummaging around in dustbins for scraps, while at night my bedroom was a park, my resting place a bench, my blanket a newspaper, my morning call the first bird to announce a new dawn. When it was too cold or wet, I retreated to the waiting room of a local railway station, where I slept below the bench and rose before the first train shunted in the next morning. As the nights became longer,
I signed up as a non-paying guest of the Salvation Army on Little George Street, where kind ladies supplied me with thick bread and thin soup before I fell asleep on a horsehair mattress below a single blanket. Luxury. As the years passed, I hoped that my former companions in arms and brother officers would assume I was dead. I had no desire for them to find out that this was the prison I'd chosen to carry out my life sentence in. And it might have stayed thus, had a Rolls-Royce not screeched to a halt in the middle of the road. The back door swung open, and out leapt a man I hadn't seen for years. "Captain Tarrant," he cried, as he advanced towards me. I looked away, hoping he'd think he'd made a mistake. But I remembered only too well that Walter Barrington was not a man who suffered from self-doubt. He grabbed me by the shoulders and stared at me for some time before he said, "How can this be possible, old fellow?" The more I tried to convince him I did not need his help, the more determined he became to be my savior. I finally gave in, but not before he had agreed to my terms and conditions. At first, he begged me to join him and his wife at the manor house, but I'd survived too long without a roof over my head to regard such comfort as anything other than a burden. He even offered me a seat on the board of the shipping company that bore his name. "What use could I possibly be to you?" I asked. "Your very presence, Jack, would be an inspiration to us all." I thanked him, but explained that I had not yet completed my sentence for the murder of 11 men. Still, he didn't give in. I finally agreed to take the job of night watchman at the docks, with £3 a week pay and accommodation provided. An abandoned Pullman railway carriage now became my prison cell. I suppose I might have continued my life sentence until the day I died, had I not come into contact with Master Harry Clifton. Harry would claim, years later, that I had shaped his whole life. In truth, it was he who saved mine. The first time I came across young Harry, he couldn't have been more than 4 or 5. "Come on in, lad," I called to him when I spotted him crawling towards the carriage on his hands and knees, but he immediately leapt up and ran away. The following Saturday, he got as far as looking in through the window. I tried again. "Why don't you come in, my boy? I'm not going to bite you," I said, trying to reassure him. This time, he took up my offer and opened the door, but after exchanging a few words, he ran away again. Was I that frightening a figure? The next Saturday, he not only opened the door, but stood feet apart in the doorway, staring at me defiantly. We chatted for over an hour, about everything from Bristol City FC to why snakes shed their skins and who built Clifton Suspension Bridge, before he said, "I'll have to be off now, Mr. Tarr. My mum's expecting me home for tea." This time he walked away, but looked back several times. After that, Harry came to visit me every Saturday until he went to Merriwood Elementary School, when he started turning up most mornings. It took me some time to convince the boy that he should stay at school and learn to read and write. Frankly, I wouldn't have managed even that without the help of Miss Munday, Mr. Holcomb, and Harry's spirited mother. It took a formidable team to get Harry Clifton to realize his potential, and I knew we had succeeded when once again he could only find the time to visit me on Saturday mornings, because he was preparing to enter for a choral scholarship to St. Bede's. Once Harry had started at his new school, I didn't expect to see him again until the Christmas holidays. But to my surprise, I found him standing outside my door just before 11 o'clock on the first Friday night of term. He told me he'd left St. Bede's because a prefect was bullying him, damned if I can recall the cad's name, and he was going to run away to sea. If he had, I suspect the boy would have ended up an admiral. But happily, he listened to my advice and was back at school in time for breakfast the following morning. Because he always used to come to the docks with Stan Tancock, it was some time before I realized Harry was Arthur Clifton's boy. He once asked me if I'd known his father, and I told him yes, and that he was a good and decent man with a fine war record. He then asked me if I knew how he died. I said I didn't. The only time I ever lied to the boy. It was not for me to ignore the wishes of his mother. I was standing on the dockside when the shift changed. No one ever gave me a second glance, almost as if I wasn't there, and I knew that some of them thought I wasn't all there. I did nothing to dispel this, as it allowed me to serve my sentence in anonymity. Arthur Clifton had been a good ganger, one of the best, and he took his job seriously, unlike his best mate, Stan Tancock, whose first port of call on the way home was always the Pig and Whistle. That was on the nights he managed to get home. I watched Clifton as he disappeared inside the hull of the Maple Leaf to make some final checks before the welders moved in to seal the double bottom. It was the raucous sound of the shift horn that must have distracted everyone. One shift coming off, another coming on, and the welders needed to get started promptly if they were going to finish the job by the end of their shift and earn their bonus. No one gave a second thought to whether Clifton had climbed back out of the double bottom, myself included. We all assumed that he must have heard the blast on the horn and was among the hundreds of dockers trooping through the gates, making their way home. Unlike his brother-in-law, Clifton rarely stopped for a pint at the Pig and Whistle, preferring to go straight to Stillhouse Lane and be with his wife and child. In those days, I didn't know his wife or child, and perhaps I never would have if Arthur Clifton had returned home that night. The second shift was working flat out when I heard Tancock shouting at the top of his voice. I saw him pointing to the ship's hull, but Haskins, the chief ganger, simply brushed him aside as if he were a tiresome wasp. Once Tancock realized he was getting nowhere with Haskins, he charged down the gangway and began to run along the quayside in the direction of Barrington House. When Haskins realized where Tancock was headed, he chased after him and had nearly caught up with him by the time he barged through the swing doors into the shipping line's headquarters. To my surprise, a few minutes later, Tancock came running back out of the building, and I was even more surprised when Haskins and the managing director followed close behind. I couldn't imagine what would have convinced Mr. Hugo to leave his office after such a brief conversation with Stan Tancock. I found out the reason soon enough, because the moment Mr. Hugo arrived on the dock, he gave orders for the entire shift to lay down their tools, stop working, and remain silent, as if it were Remembrance Sunday. And indeed, a minute later, Haskins ordered them all back to work. That was when it first occurred to me that Arthur Clifton might still be inside the double bottom. But surely no man could be so callous as to walk away if he'd thought even for a moment that someone might be trapped alive in a steel grave of their own making. When the welders went back to work, Mr. Hugo spoke to Tancock again before Tancock trooped off through the dockyard gates and out of sight. I looked back to see if Haskins was pursuing him again, but he was clearly more interested in pushing his men to their limits to recover lost time like a galley master driving his slaves. A moment later, Mr. Hugo walked down the gangway, climbed back into his car, and drove off to Barrington House. The next time I looked out of my carriage window, I saw Tancock running back through the gates and once again charging towards Barrington House. This time he didn't reappear for at least half an hour. And when he did, he was no longer red-cheeked and pulsating with rage, but appeared far calmer. I decided he must have found Clifton, and was simply letting Mr. Hugo know. I looked up at Mr. Hugo's office, and saw him standing by the window, watching Tancock as he left the yard. He didn't move away from the window until he was out of sight. A few minutes later, Mr. Hugo came out of the building, walked across to his car, and drove away. I wouldn't have given the matter another thought if Arthur Clifton had clocked in for the morning shift. But he didn't, nor did he ever again. The following morning, a Detective Inspector Blakemore paid me a visit in my carriage. You can often judge the character of a person by the way he treats his fellow men. Blakemore was one of those rare people who could see beyond his nose. "You say that you saw Stanley Tancock leaving Barrington House between 7 and 7:30 yesterday evening?" "Yes, I did," I told him. "Did he appear to be in a hurry, or anxious, or attempting to slip away unnoticed?" "On the contrary," I said. "I remember thinking at the time he looked remarkably carefree, given the circumstances." "Given the circumstances?" repeated Blakemore. "Only an hour or so earlier, he'd been protesting that his mate, Arthur Clifton, was trapped in the double bottom of the Maple Leaf, and they were doing nothing to help him." Blakemore wrote down my words in his notebook. "Do you have any idea where Tancock went after that?" "No," I replied. "When I last saw him, he was walking out of the gates with an arm around one of his mates." "Thank you, sir," said the detective inspector. "That's been most helpful." It had been a long time since anyone had called me sir. "Would you be willing, at your own convenience, to come down to the station and make a written statement?" "I'd prefer not to, Inspector," I told him, "for personal reasons, but I'd be quite happy to write out a statement that you could collect at any time that suits you." "That's good of you, sir." The detective inspector opened his briefcase, dug out a police statement sheet, and handed it to me. He then raised his hat and said, "Thank you, sir, I'll be in touch." But I never saw him again. 6 weeks later, Stan Tancock was sentenced to 3 years' imprisonment for theft, with Mr. Hugo acting as the prosecution's principal witness. I attended every day of the trial, and there wasn't any doubt in my mind which one of them was the guilty party. Chapter 28. Try not to forget that you saved my life. "I've spent the last 26 years trying to forget," old Jack reminded him. "But you were also responsible for saving the lives of 24 of your fellow West countrymen. You remain a hero in this city, and you seem to be totally unaware of the fact. So I'm bound to ask, Jack, how much longer you intend to go on torturing yourself?" "Until I can no longer see the 11 men I killed as clearly as I can see you now." "But you were doing no more than your duty," protested Sir Walter. "That's how I saw it at the time," admitted Jack. "So what changed?" "If I could answer that question," replied Jack, "we wouldn't be having this conversation." "But you're still capable of doing so much for your fellow men. Take that young friend of yours, for example. You tell me he keeps playing truant, but if he was to discover that you are Captain Jack Tarrant of the Royal Gloucestershire Regiment, winner of the Victoria Cross, don't you think he might listen to you with even more respect?"
"He might also run away again," replied Jack. "In any case, I have other plans for young Harry Clifton."
"Clifton, Clifton?"
said Sir Walter. "Why is that name familiar?"
"Harry's father was trapped in the double bottom of the maple leaf, and no one came to his—"
"That's not what I heard," said Sir Walter, his tone changing. "I was told that Clifton left his wife because she was, not to put too fine a point on it, a loose woman."
"Then you were misled," said Jack, "because I can tell you that Mrs. Clifton is a delightful and intelligent woman, and any man who was lucky enough to be married to her would never want to leave her."
Sir Walter looked genuinely shocked, and it was some time before he spoke again.
"Surely you don't believe that cock-and-bull story about Clifton being trapped in the double bottom?" he asked quietly. "I'm afraid I do, Walter. You see, I witnessed the whole episode."
"And why didn't you say something about it at the time?"
"I did, when I was interviewed by Detective Inspector Blakemore the following day. I told him everything I'd seen, and at his request I made a written statement."
"And why wasn't your statement produced in evidence at Tancock's trial?" asked Sir Walter.
"Because I never saw Blakemore again. And when I turned up at the police station, I was told he was no longer in charge of the case, and his replacement refused to see me."
"I had Blakemore taken off the case," said Sir Walter. "The damn man was as good as accusing Hugo of giving the money to Tancock, so there wouldn't be an investigation into the Clifton affair."
Old Jack remained silent. "Let's not talk of this any more," said Sir Walter. "I know my son is far from perfect, but I refuse to believe—"
"Or perhaps you don't want to believe," said old Jack. "Jack, whose side are you on?"
"On the side of justice, as you used to be when we first met."
"And I still am," said Sir Walter.
But he fell silent for some time before adding, "I want you to make me a promise, Jack. If you ever find out anything about Hugo that you believe would harm the family's reputation, you won't hesitate to tell me."
"You have my word on it. And you have my word, old friend, that I would not hesitate to hand Hugo over to the police if I thought for one moment that he had broken the law."
"Let's hope nothing else arises that would make that necessary," said old Jack.
"I agree, old friend. Let's talk of more palatable things. Is there anything you are in need of at the moment? I could still—"
"Do you have any old clothes that are surplus to requirements?"
Sir Walter raised an eyebrow.
"Dare I ask?"
"No, you daren't," said old Jack. "But I have to visit a particular gentleman, and I'll need to be appropriately dressed."
Old Jack had grown so thin over the years that Sir Walter's clothes hung off him like flax on a distaff, and, like Sir Andrew Aguecheek, he was several inches taller than his old friend, so he had to let down the turnips on the trousers, and even then they barely reached his ankles. But he felt that the tweed suit, checked shirt and striped tie would serve its purpose for this particular meeting. As Jack walked out of the dockyard for the first time in years, a few familiar faces turned to give the smartly dressed stranger a second look. When the school bell rang at 4 o'clock, old Jack stepped back into the shadows while the noisy, boisterous nippers poured out through the gates of Merriwood Elementary as if they were escaping from prison. Mrs. Clifton had been waiting there for the past 10 minutes, and when Harry saw his mum, he reluctantly allowed her to take him by the hand. "A damn fine-looking woman," old Jack thought, as he watched the two of them walking away, Harry, as always, jumping up and down, endlessly chattering, displaying as much energy as Stevenson's rocket. Old Jack waited until they were out of sight before he crossed the road and walked into the schoolyard. If he'd been dressed in his old clothes, he would have been stopped by someone in authority long before he reached the front door. He looked up and down the corridor and spotted a master coming towards him.
"I'm sorry to trouble you," said old Jack, "but I'm looking for Mr. Holcomb."
"Third door on the left, old fella," the man said, pointing down the corridor. When old Jack came to a halt outside Mr. Holcomb's classroom, he gave a gentle tap on the door. "Come in." Old Jack opened the door to find a young man, his long black gown covered in chalk dust, seated at a table in front of rows of empty desks, marking exercise books.
"I'm sorry to disturb you," said old Jack. "I'm looking for Mr. Holcomb."
"Then you need look no further," said the schoolmaster, putting down his pen.
"My name is Tar," he said, as he stepped forward, "but my friends call me Jack."
Holcomb's face lit up. "I do believe you're the man Harry Clifton goes off to visit most mornings."
"I fear I am," admitted old Jack. "I apologize."
"No need," said Holcomb. "I only wish I had the same influence over him that you do."
"That's why I came to see you, Mr. Holcomb. I'm convinced that Harry is an exceptional child and should be given every chance to make the best of his talents."
"I couldn't agree with you more," said Holcomb, "and I suspect he has one talent even you don't know about."
"And what might that be?"
"He has the voice of an angel."
"Harry's no angel," said old Jack with a grin.
"I quite agree, but it may turn out to be our best chance of breaking down his defenses."
"What do you have in mind?" asked old Jack.
"There's a possibility he might just be tempted to join the choir at Holy Nativity, so if you were able to convince him to come to school more often, I know I can teach him to read and write."
"Why is that so important for a church choir?"
"It's compulsory at Holy Nativity, and Miss Monday, the choir mistress, refuses to make any exceptions to the rule."
"Then I'll just have to make sure the boy attends your lessons, won't I?" said old Jack.
"You could do more than that. On the days he doesn't come to school, you could teach him yourself."
"But I'm not qualified to teach anyone."
"Harry Clifton is not impressed by qualifications, and we both know that he listens to you. Perhaps we could work as a team."
"But if Harry were to find out what we were up to, neither of us would ever see him again."
"How well you know him," said the schoolmaster with a sigh. "We'll just have to make sure he doesn't find out."
"That may prove something of a challenge," said old Jack, "but I'm willing to give it a try."
"Thank you, sir," said Mr. Holcomb. The schoolmaster paused before adding, "I wonder if I might be allowed to shake hands with you."
Old Jack looked surprised as the schoolmaster thrust out his hand.
Old Jack shook it warmly. "And may I say, it has been an honour to meet you, Captain Tarrant."
Old Jack looked horrified. "How could you possibly—"
"My father has a picture of you that still hangs on the wall in our front room."
"But why?" asked old Jack.
"You saved his life, sir." Harry's visits to old Jack became less frequent during the next few weeks, until the only time they met was on a Saturday morning.
Old Jack knew that Mr. Holcomb must have succeeded in his plan when Harry asked him if he would come to Holy Nativity the following Sunday to hear him sing.
On Sunday morning, old Jack rose early, used Sir Walter's private cloakroom on the fifth floor of Barrington House to have a shower, a recent invention, and even trimmed his beard before putting on the other suit Sir Walter had given him. Arriving at Holy Nativity just before the service began, he slipped into the back row and took a seat at the end of the pew. He spotted Mrs. Clifton in the third row, sitting between what could only have been her mother and father. As for Miss Monday, he could have picked her out in a congregation of 1,000. Mr. Holcomb had not been exaggerating about the quality of Harry's voice. It was as good as anything he could remember from his days at Wells Cathedral. As soon as the boy opened his mouth to sing, "Lead Me, Lord," old Jack was left in no doubt that his protégé had an exceptional gift. Once the Reverend Watts had given his final blessing, old Jack slipped back out of the church and quickly made his way to the docks. He would have to wait until the following Saturday before he could tell the boy how much he'd enjoyed his singing.
As he walked back, old Jack recalled Sir Walter's reproach.
"You could do so much more for Harry if you would only give up this self-denial."
He thought carefully about Sir Walter's words, but he wasn't yet ready to remove the shackles of guilt. He did, however, know a man who could change Harry's life, a man who had been with him on that dreadful day, a man he hadn't spoken to for more than 25 years, a man who taught at a school that supplied St. Mary Redcliffe with choristers. Unfortunately, Merriwood Elementary was not a natural recruiting ground for its annual choral scholarship, so the man would have to be guided in the right direction. Old Jack's only fear was that Lieutenant Frobisher might not remember him. Chapter 29 Old Jack waited until Hugo had left Barrington House, but it was another half an hour before the lights finally went out in Miss Potts's room. Jack stepped out of the railway carriage and began to walk slowly towards Barrington House, aware that he had only half an hour before the cleaning ladies came on duty. He slipped into the unlit building and climbed the stairs to the fifth floor. After 25 years of Sir Walter turning a blind eye, like a cat he could find his way to the door marked Managing Director in the dark. He sat down at Hugo's desk. He switched on the light. If anyone noticed it was on, they would simply assume Miss Potts was working late. He thumbed through the telephone directory until he came to the Saints. Andrews, Bartholomew's, Beatrice's, Bede's. He picked up a telephone for the first time in his life, not quite sure what to do next. A voice came on the line. "Number, please."
TEM 8612, said Jack, his forefinger resting just below the number.
"Thank you, sir." As he waited, old Jack became more nervous by the minute. What would he say if someone else came on the line? He just put the phone down. He took a piece of paper out of his pocket, unfolded it, and laid it out on the desk in front of him. Next he heard a ringing tone, followed by a click, then a man's voice. "Frobisher House."
"Is that Noel Frobisher?" he asked, recalling the tradition that each house at St. Bede's was named after the housemaster of the day. He looked down at his script. Each line had been carefully prepared and endlessly rehearsed.
"Speaking," said Frobisher, clearly surprised to hear a voice he didn't recognize addressing him by his Christian name. A long silence followed.
"Is there anyone there?" Frobisher asked, sounding a little irritated.
"Yes. It's Captain Jack Tarrant." There was an even longer silence before Frobisher eventually said, "Good evening, sir." "Forgive me for calling at this late hour, old fellow, but I need to seek your advice."
"Not at all, sir. It's a great privilege to speak to you after all these years."
"Kind of you to say so," said old Jack. "I'll try not to waste too much of your time. But I need to know if St. Bede's still supplies St. Mary Redcliffe with trebles for its choir."
"We do indeed, sir. Despite so many changes in this modern world, that's one tradition that remains constant."
"And in my day," said old Jack, "the school awarded a choral scholarship each year to a treble who showed exceptional talent."
"We still do, sir. In fact, we will be considering applications for the position in the next few weeks."
"From any school in the county?"
"Yes, from any school that can produce a treble of outstanding quality, but they must also have a solid academic grounding."
"Well, if that's the case," said old Jack, "I would like to submit a candidate for your consideration."
"Of course, sir."
"Which school is the boy attending at the moment?"
"Merriwood Elementary."
Another long silence followed.
"I have to admit that it would be the first time we've had an applicant from that particular school.
Do you by any chance know the name of its music master?"
"It doesn't have a music master," said old Jack,
but you should get in touch with the boy's teacher, Mr. Holcomb, who will introduce you to his choir mistress.
May I ask the boy's name? Said Frobisher.
Harry Clifton. If you want to hear him sing, I recommend you attend Matins at Holy Nativity Church this Sunday.
Will you be there, sir?
No, said Old Jack.
How do I get in touch with you once I've heard the boy sing?
Asked Frobisher. You don't, said Old Jack firmly, and put the phone down.
As he folded up his script and placed it back in his pocket, he could have sworn he heard footsteps crunching across the gravel outside. He quickly switched off the light, slipped out of Mr. Hugo's office and into the corridor. He heard a door open and voices on the stairs. The last thing he needed was to be found on the fifth floor, which was strictly out of bounds to anyone other than the company's executives and Miss Potts. He wouldn't want to embarrass Sir Walter. He began to walk quickly down the stairs. He'd reached the third floor when he saw Mrs. Nettles heading towards him, a mop in one hand, a bucket in the other, a woman he didn't recognize by her side.
"Good evening, Mrs. Nettles," said Old Jack, "and what a fine evening it is to be doing my rounds."
"Evening, Old Jack," she replied as she ambled past him.
Once he had turned the corner, he stopped and listened attentively.
"That's Old Jack," he heard Mrs. Nettles say, "the so-called night watchman. He's completely crackers, but quite harmless. So if you come across him, just ignore him."
Old Jack chuckled as her voice faded with each step she took. As he strolled back towards the railway carriage, he wondered how long it would be before Harry came to seek his advice on whether he should enter his name for a choral scholarship to St. Bede's.
Chapter 30 Harry knocked on the carriage door, strolled in, and took the seat opposite Old Jack in first class. During term time at St. Bede's, Harry had only been able to see Old Jack regularly on Saturday mornings. Jack had returned the compliment by attending Matins at St. Mary Redcliffe, where from the back pew he enjoyed watching Mr. Frobisher and Mr. Holcomb beam with pride at his protégé. In the school holidays, Old Jack could never be sure exactly when Harry was going to turn up, because he treated the railway carriage like a second home. Whenever he returned to St. Bede's at the beginning of a new term, Old Jack missed the boy's company. He was touched when Mrs. Clifton described him as the father Harry never had. In truth, Harry was the son he'd always wanted.
"Finished your paper round early," said Old Jack, rubbing his eyes and blinking, when Harry strolled into the carriage that Saturday morning.
"No, you just dozed off, old man," said Harry, passing him a copy of the previous day's Times.
"And you're getting cheekier by the day, young man," Old Jack said with a grin. "So, how's the paper round working out?"
"Good. I think I'm going to be able to save enough money to buy my mom a watch."
"A sensible present, considering your mother's new job. But can you afford it?"
"I've already saved 4 shillings, said Harry. "I reckon I'll have about 6 by the end of the holidays."
"Have you chosen the watch you want?"
"Yes, it's in Mr. Deacon's display cabinet, but it won't be there for much longer," said Harry, grinning.
Deacon's, a name Old Jack could never forget.
"How much is it?" he asked.
"No idea," said Harry. "I'm not going to ask Mr. Deacon's until the day before I go back to school." Old Jack wasn't sure how to tell the boy that 6 shillings wasn't going to be enough to buy a watch, so he changed the subject.
"I hope the paper round isn't stopping you from studying. I'm sure I don't have to remind you that the exams are getting closer by the day."
"You're worse than the Frobe," said Harry. "But you'll be pleased to learn that I'm spending 2 hours every morning in the library with Deacons, and another 2 most afternoons."
"Most afternoons?"
"Well, Giles and I do occasionally go to the Flicks, and as Gloucestershire are playing Yorkshire at the county ground next week, it'll be a chance to see Herbert Sutcliffe batting."
"You'll miss Giles when he goes to Eton," said Old Jack.
He's still working on his father to let him join me and Deacons at BGS.
Deacons and me, said old Jack, and be warned, if Mr. Hugo has made up his mind, it will take more than Giles to shift him.
Mr. Barrington doesn't like me, said Harry,
taking old Jack by surprise.
What makes you say that?
He treats me differently from the other boys at St. Bede's. It's as if I'm not good enough to be a friend of his son.
You're going to have to face that problem all your life, Harry, said old Jack. The English are the biggest snobs on earth, and most of the time without reason. The lesser the talent, the bigger the snob, in my experience. It's the only way the so-called upper classes can hope to survive. Be warned, my boy. They don't care for upstarts like you who barge into their club without an invitation.
But you don't treat me like that, said Harry.
That's because I'm not upper class, said old Jack, laughing.
Perhaps not. But my mum says you're first class, said Harry. So that's what I want to be.
It didn't help that old Jack couldn't tell Harry the real reason Mr. Hugo was always so offhand. He sometimes wished he hadn't been in the wrong place at the wrong time and witnessed what had really happened the day the boy's father died.
"Have you fallen asleep again, old man?" said Harry. "Because I can't hang around chatting to you all day. I promised my mum I'd meet her at Clark's in the Broad because she wants to buy me a new pair of shoes. Not that I can see what's wrong with the pair I've got."
"Special lady, your mum," said old Jack.
"That's why I'm buying her a watch," said Harry.
The bell above the door rang as he entered the shop. Old Jack hoped that enough time had passed to ensure that Private Deacons wouldn't remember him.
"Good morning, sir. How can I help you?"
Old Jack couldn't fail to recognize Mr. Deacons immediately. He smiled and walked across to the display cabinet and studied the two watches on the top shelf. "I just need to know the price of this Ingersoll."
"The ladies' or the gentleman's model, sir?" asked Mr. Deacons, coming out from behind the counter.
"The ladies," said old Jack.
Deacons unlocked the cabinet with his one hand, deftly removed the watch from its stand, checked the label, and said, "16 shillings, sir."
"Good," said old Jack, and placed a 10-bob note on the counter. Mr. Deacons looked even more puzzled. "When Harry Clifton asks you how much the watch is, Mr. Deacons, please tell him it's 6 shillings, because that's how much he will have saved by the time he stops working for you, and I know he's hoping to buy it as a present for his mother."
"You must be old Jack," said Deacons. "He'll be so touched that you—"
"But you won't ever tell him," said old Jack, looking Mr. Deacons in the eye. "I want him to believe that the price of the watch is 6 shillings.
"I understand," said Mr. Deacons, placing the watch back on the stand.
"And how much is the man's watch?"
£1.
"Would you allow me to put down another 10 bob as a deposit, and then give you 0.5 crown a week for the next month, until I've paid off the full amount?"
"That is quite acceptable, sir. But wouldn't you like to try it on first?"
"No, thank you," said old Jack. "It's not for me. I'm going to give it to Harry when he wins a scholarship to Bristol Grammar School."
"I had thought the same," said Mr. Deacons, "should my son Algy be fortunate enough to win one."
"Then you'd better order another one pretty quickly," said old Jack, "because Harry tells me your son's a racing certainty."
Mr. Deacons laughed and took a closer look at old Jack.
"Have we met before, sir?"
"I don't think so," said old Jack, and left the shop without another word.
Chapter 31. If Mohammed won't come to the mountain... Old Jack smiled to himself as he rose to greet Mr. Holcombe and offered him a seat.
"Would you care to join me in the buffet car for a cup of tea?" old Jack asked. "Mrs. Clifton was kind enough to supply me with a quite excellent packet of Earl Grey."
"No, thank you, sir," said Holcombe. "I've only just had breakfast."
"So the boy just missed out on a scholarship," said old Jack, assuming that was what the schoolmaster had come to see him about.
"Failed is how Harry looks upon it," said Holcombe, "despite coming 17th out of 300 and being offered a place in the school's A stream this September. But will he be able to accept the offer? It will place an extra financial burden on his mother."
"As long as there are no unexpected bombshells, she should be able to get Harry through the next 5 years."
"Even so, Harry won't be able to afford the little extras most of the other boys will take for granted."
"Possibly, but I've managed to cover some of his sundry expenses from the school's list, so he'll be able to consider at least two of the three extracurricular activities he's keen to sign up for."
"Let me guess," said old Jack. "The choir, the theatre club, and
art appreciation," said Holcombe.
"Miss Munday and Miss Tilly are taking responsibility for any trips the choir might make. I'm covering the theatre club, and so I get art appreciation," said old Jack. "His new passion. I can still hold my own with Harry when it comes to Rembrandt and Vermeer. Even this new chap, Matisse. Now he's trying to get me interested in a Spaniard called Picasso, but I can't see it myself."
"I've never heard of him," admitted Holcombe.
"And I doubt if you ever will," said old Jack. "But don't tell Harry I said so."
He picked up a small tin box, opened it, and took out three notes and almost all the coins he possessed.
"No, no," said Holcombe. "That isn't the reason I came to see you. In fact, I plan to visit Mr. Craddock later this afternoon, and I'm confident he'll—"
"I think you'll find that I take precedence over Mr. Craddock," said old Jack, handing across the money.
"That's very generous of you."
"Money well spent," said old Jack, "even if it is the widow's mite. At least my father would approve," he added as an afterthought.
"Your father?" repeated Holcombe.
"He's the resident canon at Wells Cathedral."
"I had no idea," said Holcombe.
"So at least you'll be able to visit him from time to time." "Sadly not. I fear I am a modern prodigal son," said old Jack. Not wishing to go any further down that road, he said, "So, tell me, young man, why did you want to see me?"
"I can't remember the last occasion anyone called me young man."
"Just be grateful that anyone still does," said old Jack.
Holcombe laughed. "I've got a couple of tickets for the school play, Julius Caesar. As Harry is performing, I thought you might like to join me for the opening night."
"I knew he was auditioning," said old Jack. "What part did he get?"
"He's playing Sinner," said Holcombe.
"Then we'll know him by his gait."
Holcombe bowed low. "Does that mean you'll join me?"